in the history of the church. And this is a really interesting kind of argument, okay? Because he's picking the coronation of a guy who was already a ruler, and he'd been a ruler for a long time, but the coming of the title, the bestowing of the title of Holy Roman Emperor, basically what Noel is going to argue sets in stone some things about the medieval world that are going to persist. Certainly, Sam and I were just talking before the class started, are going to largely determine some differences between Western Christianity and especially church-state relationships versus the East. Okay, so in this chapter, I kind of Noel's not easy. He's not easy to sometimes distill. Here are the main points that I need to talk about. And so if you read these chapters for yourself, you may come up with a different sort of, well, I would have said it this way, or I would have made these my head points. So I came up with these four things that I thought really needed to be stressed from this chapter. So it's not bad to read the book for yourself and see what you come up with. All right, so the first thing we're going to talk about is the rise of the papacy. So back to chapter 1, the New Testament sort of intermingling of episkopos and presbyteros, so the Greek word for bishop and the Greek word for elder, they seem to be the same, okay, in the New Testament. And it's clear by the mid-second century, so, you know, the year 150 AD, that episkopos is sort of the boss job. Okay, so there still are presbyteros. That word eventually becomes the English word priest. Okay, so if you're at all familiar with the Roman Catholic system of church government, or the Episcopal system of church government, the Anglican system, Methodists have this. Okay, there are bishops, and then there are ministers or priests. Okay, so that bishop-priest structure, by the middle of the second century, seems to be how the church has kind of settled this. So a bishop is sort of over the priests. So a priest would be the pastor of our church. Okay, the bishop would be the guy who's overseeing lots of individual church pastors. Okay, so in the Presbyterian system, we have a presiding minister that gets elected in our denomination, then, you know, we don't have an episcopal system. We don't have a bishop. Now, you could argue, like when I went to Peru, Alonzo Ramirez functioned in the Presbyterian system. He functioned as a bishop. Okay, he was overseeing all of the ministers in northern Peru, all the Presbyterian ministers in northern Peru. He was a bishop. He was functioning as a bishop. So we don't call him a bishop, but there you go. Okay, so I think it's a perfectly sort of natural and normal thing to say, okay, this is how the church figured out how they needed to govern themselves. And I don't think you need to look at it and say, you know, like kind of like I used to do, oh, episcopacy evil, you know, it's ungodly. I think it's just a natural development. I think the Presbyterian system tries to do justice to what seems to be the New Testament arrangement, okay? And I know that in this church we have had, you know, months and months and months of dialogue and sometimes disagreement about, okay, you know, Presbyterians have this many offices. What do we think? Okay, so, you know, the two-office view, the three-office view, the two-and-a-half-office view, all of this stuff is church government stuff. So, again, it still occupies Christians today. Okay, so in the early church, though, this word papa, which we're all going to recognize, you know, means daddy, right? In most languages, okay, papa means daddy. There were bishops that multiple bishops that we refer to as papas. Okay, in other words, they're the daddy. They're the daddy bishop. Okay, so they weren't called archbishops. They weren't called, you know, any kind of other, you know, prelate, any type of other name. They were just papas. So these tended to be the churches that had historic significance in very early Christian history. So Antioch, we talked about that a couple chapters ago. Alexandria, which is not really mentioned in the Bible like Antioch is, but very early on it was a hub of Christian thought and teaching, and because of the academic centers that had been there, it's kind of a hotbed for theology. Rome, okay? Rome's a natural. That's where both Peter and Paul are martyred. Lots of the focus at the end of the New Testament is on what's going on in Rome. There were several papas. Okay, well, that word papa is what's going to become the word in English, pope, right? And it was a long time though before the Bishop of Rome was recognized as the only papa in the West. Now, the East never settled for this. The East never said the Bishop of Rome is the top bishop. Okay, the East said, well, you got Antioch. He's pretty old, you know, long history there. You got Alexandria. Okay, so there was never any agreement between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And eventually, the chief bishop position in the East went to Constantinople because that's where the emperor was. Okay, so the bishop of Constantinople was sort of the boss in the East. The bishop in Rome was the boss in the West. And naturally enough, you start to get some contention there, okay? So I've listed a series of popes, okay, bishops of Rome, better. And so these guys are significant because they sort of, you can track a historical development of how much authority they're claiming for the Bishop of Rome. So here is Stephen in the middle of the 3rd century. He is basically saying, hey, everybody, the Bishop of Rome is probably the most important, you know, voice in the church. Okay, so he's not claiming, you know, infallibility or absolute, you know, sway over all the other bishops. But he is saying, hey, this is an important job. Okay, 100 years later or so, Damasus the First kind of strengthens the claim. Okay, so he's going to make a stronger argument that the authority of the Bishop of Rome is really the supreme authority if there's a dispute. Okay, now, two thoughts. Okay, first thought is the West had their theology together sooner and better than the East did. So there's an advantage to the Bishop of Rome being the most important voice because the West isn't messed up. Okay, theologically, like the East tends to be. However, hopefully everybody else realizes that, you know, there is some arbitrariness here, okay? If you're familiar with Roman Catholic theology, you know, Jesus saying, you know, you're Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and then the later passage, you know, if you retain sins, they're retained. If you release them, they're released. Okay, you know, those two passages are the entire biblical fabric of, okay, this is Jesus making whoever's the Bishop of Rome the boss of the church. Okay, the historical argument is probably stronger than the biblical argument, okay, that, you know, this tended to be the place where the church just recognized, yeah, whoever's that bishop probably does have the say. Okay, we talked 2 times ago about Leo the Great. So Leo the Great basically is going to settle in the West at the time of the Council of Chalcedon Christological doctrine. And he's going to basically enforce, you know, biblical teachings about Christ in the West. And there's not going to be really any argument in the West after Leo the Great. Next guy that kind of makes a bigger stand 30 years later, Glacius, and I think I've got, these are just their reigns as Pope, not their lifespans up here. Glacius basically says, the Bishop of Rome is it. Okay, so he makes the first sort of absolute claim. You know, I don't care what any of you guys say. Now, every time this stuff gets published, of course, the guys in the East are going, you know, you can't just say that. And so, naturally, that's going to worsen relations between the East and the West. But now, with Glacius, we're post the fall of Rome as a political, you know, there's no more emperors in Rome after 476. So, you know, the only Roman emperor is in Constantinople. It's the new, you know, absolute seat of imperial authority. Okay, so you can see that this isn't just going to sort of fly versus East to West. Remember at the Council of Chalcedon, there were only two delegates from the West. Leo sent two priests over. It was all Eastern bishops. Okay, so by the time that Gregory the Great comes along, Gregory the Great is typically sort of recognized as the Pope that finally just sort of makes what we're used to in our day, this absolute claim that the Bishop of Rome is the authority over the church. Now, it's still one church. So Gregory can claim all this. Nobody in the East is going to say, yeah, that's okay. Okay, but it's just going to sort of be functionally, the West has the Bishop of Rome, the East has the Bishop of Constantinople, and they're just going to sort of agree to disagree for about another 500 years. Okay, but eventually, this is what's going to lead to the split between East and West, which is the next chapter. So, Gregory the Great, whose picture is up there, is really a remarkable guy. Yes, Ken? So, yeah, I mean, us Protestants make an argument that the Catholics are misinterpreting that verse, that basically, you know, the words are slightly variant. And so what Ken's alluding to is this idea that the word for Peter is like a small rock and the word used for upon this rock is a big rock. So it's not saying Peter is the rock, that rock. Okay, that's sort of the basic Protestant argument. Okay, it's, yes, Nate?
And it's what Peter has said right before that.
Yeah.
That is the rock.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, his confession of Jesus as the Christ, Son of the living God, is the rock itself. I will say this. As you're going to see as we get into the rest of this chapter, so much of what's going to come after the crowning of Charlemagne is just typical human political machinations. Okay, so much of this, and I'm not trying to be super cynical, but so much of this just devolves to people that want power and influence and authority and frankly wealth and how to get more of it. Okay, so that's where this is all going. So to me, arguments that I think, again, one of the things that I changed my view in is realizing how early the claim of the Bishop of Rome really was to primacy. I would have put it later. I would have put it like Leo and Gregory. Okay, so there were some much earlier recognitions of this that earlier Christians saw this, but again, where this is going is not a good place, and you can understand the need for the Reformation by the time we get to 1500. So Gregory is just a remarkable guy. He is a reformer. Okay, so he's trying to clean up problems in the church, abuses in the church. One of the things he does is he writes a life of Benedict. So Benedict was featured in last chapter. This is going to popularize monastic vocations. Okay, so that book drove people to say, if I want to live for Christ, I'm going to enter, you know, take holy orders, enter a monastery. So it popularized that. He was the leader. Okay, so remember, the Romans had, essentially, Roman soldiers had evangelized England up to the Hadrian's Wall. Okay, so when they start retreating, they're leaving a bunch of Christian Celtic people. You know, that's who they invaded when they came in. All the Romans are leaving. The Celts have all been evangelized. They're all Christians. And the ones in England and Wales. And so as they are leaving, the Celts get invaded by non-Christian Angles and Saxons and later Vikings. England goes largely pagan again following the retreat of the Romans in the early 4th century. And so Gregory sends the other Augustine, okay, not the famous writer who was African. This guy goes up to evangelize, re-evangelize England. And it's said that Gregory had an opportunity when he's in Rome, walking around to see a little English boy who was a slave. Okay, and he was an Angle, and so in Latin he said non Angli, not an Angle, said Angeli, but an angel. Okay, so he said, if this is what the people of England look like, how can we let them stay pagan? Okay, so tremendous boost there for all the blondies in the world and God's love of blonde people. Look at the fear points here. God loves you more than he loves anybody else. Die, your family. Okay. Clearly, that's what the point is here. Okay. So he also is going to essentially preside over the most important event until Henry VIII in English Christianity, which is the Synod of Whitby. Okay. So. The Celtic Church had a lot of differences from the Roman Church. Okay? And the Synod of Whitby's in England, is going to be a convocation of bishops in which they're going to basically settle which version of Christianity is going to apply to the English Isles. So, one of the most important aspects is the Celts, their priests married. Okay, so, you know, we as Protestants think the celibacy of the priesthood is like this big. Okay, they've always done it this way. You know, Eastern priests marry still, okay, and did back then. The Celtic priests married. You know, it's really a Roman thing that, and we talked about celibacy last week with monastic stuff. It's really kind of a Roman thing that, priests aren't going to marry. So, you know, we're witnesses in the last 25 years to the horrific scandals in the Roman Catholic Church with, you know, priests being bad actors sexually. If you go back and read early Reformation stuff, that was one of the big points that the Reformers were pointing out, is that the lack of actual sexual purity in the priesthood and the monks and the nuns was a huge problem in the church. And a lot of these medieval popes were just, you know, they're profligates. Okay, so the Synod of Whitby basically decides against the Celtic practices where they differ from the Romans and sets that sort of in place. And then Gregory really did want to make up with the East. So Gregory spent a lot of his efforts and time in trying to make up with the Bishop of Constantinople and other, and he made some progress. So the fact that the East-West split doesn't happen until, you know, the middle of the 11th century, it's largely due to guys like Gregory who saw that, you know, we need to be on the same team, we need to be unified. But again, following the fall of Rome and sort of the dissolution of any kind of unified political entity in the western half of Europe and in North Europe, you know, things got tough all over. because you just had these tribal chieftains basically running things. Okay, so Gregory, fantastic guy by all accounts, you know, very, very faithful, pious guy. And he did a lot of good. He did a lot of good for the church, and he really, again, this pattern I said last week of just these reforming popes coming out of the monastic system, you know, trying to make things better, you know, he's a good example of that. All right, so the second big issue that occurs in this time period is the rise of Islam. Okay, so we're very familiar with Islam today because, you know, basically for the last 25 years, we've been fighting a war on terror, and the terrorists are, you know, largely Islamic, right? Okay, until last few weeks, they are well-educated Ivy Leaguers who've adopted Hamas as their pet pony. The guy that they refer to as the Prophet Muhammad was born in the year 570 in the Arabian Peninsula. And basically, he claims to have had some visions and been miraculously transported some places. And he basically writes down all of this stuff as what we would call the Quran. Okay, so not telling you to go read the Quran. I have read the Quran. It is an interesting study just to kind of understand the difference in quality between the Bible and the Quran. And it is, yes,
I? I don't think he actually wrote it down.
No, I don't think he did either. Okay, but the nature of the Quran is very different than the Bible for the most part. Okay, there are sections stylistically in the book of Proverbs that's close, okay? But that's about it. And then it's got all kinds of stuff that is not really terribly systemized or systemizable. So, you know, in the Bible, you do get long, complicated theological arguments, okay? You know, think of the book of Romans. Okay, that's like a PhD in philosophy level complicated argument. Okay, you don't see any of that really in the Quran. Okay, so he basically isolated there in the middle of the desert. He gets booted out of Mecca. He goes to the city of Medina. Village of Medina, comes back to Mecca with a small army, you know, a couple hundred guys, captures Mecca. So just, you know, in terms of understanding the dynamics of modern Islam, you know, Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem are kind of the three holy sites, right? Okay, and he's said to have traveled in a kind of a ecstatic vision sort of deal to Jerusalem, been talked to by an angel. Basically, here you are out in the middle of the desert. Essentially, Muhammad is claiming to have revelation post-Christ that sort of fulfills Judaism and Christianity. So it's often by scholars, you know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are sort of lumped together as the three monotheistic religions. From an Islamic point of view, they complete us. So you know how we look at, you know, Jews who haven't accepted Christ as, you know, come on over into the, you know, your religion's not complete until you come over to us. That's how Islam looks at us. Okay, there's one more prophet. You know, Jesus is great, but there's one more. Okay, now if you just think back to the previous two chapters about everything that, you know, is stated about who God is and who Jesus is in Nicaea and Chalcedon, you know, Muhammad doesn't fit in with any of that, right? That's just going to get rejected as not even a good Christian heresy, right? It's not even a good heresy. It's not even tempting, okay? But Islam has the feature where there's an armed band, and they are very, very, very interested in aggrandizing their territorial footprint. Okay, so that's in the very roots and beginning of Islam. And so it's really something just to watch the spread of Islam from the Arabian Peninsula kind of up through the Middle East, across North Africa, and up against, you know, through Asia Minor, up against Constantinople itself, all the way around into Spain. Okay? And so, you know, between, you know, Muhammad's death in 630, you know, you get this rapid expansion of Islam. Now, Islamic conquerors in the 7th and 8th centuries and 9th centuries and 10th centuries often did not, you know, they didn't execute Christians and they didn't execute Jews. Okay? They looked at them kind of like modern evangelicals look at Jews. Like, you know, you're kind of on the same team. You're not all the way in, but you're kind of where we came from. So we have the spot in our heart. And, you know, modern American evangelicalism is like so pro-Judaism and pro-Israel, it's like, it's crazy, right? And it's like you don't have to be a Christian to be saved. If you're a Jew and you live in Israel, that's good enough. Okay, so that's bad theology. But, you know, there are plenty of good arguments for saying that, you know, America should be on Israel's side. You know, I'm not necessarily knocking that. But they don't, Muslims don't look at Christians as the infidel that has to be eradicated instantly. Okay, so as they spread, they basically are fairly tolerant of allowing those religions to continue. Because remember, the Middle East and North Africa and Asia Minor are 99% Christian at this time. Okay, and so the problem is that they're a long way from Constantinople, and a lot of the areas where they live that are being conquered they're not anybody's breadbasket. You know, Egypt is the Egyptians' breadbasket, nobody else's. So they're not taking anything of dramatic economic worth. If you've been to most of Turkey, if you've been to North Africa, I mean, they're lovely places if you like the desert and arid places, certainly full of history. But, you know, it's not like taking over the Central Valley of California. You know, you're not going to feed the Northern Hemisphere with what comes out of there. Okay? So, basically, they sweep west across North Africa, and they get up to Constantinople in 40 years, so they're pushing there. And in the year 711, so that's 80 years after Muhammad's death, they've crossed over from the tip of North Africa into Gibraltar. Okay, so they're in Spain, and they are going to essentially take over Spain for a while, and seven centuries, and they're going to head for Paris. Okay, so that the map I've got up there shows sort of the western half, because that's what we're going to focus on. But essentially, the thought of every, you know, I'm not going to say the word Dark Ages, but that's the time period that Enlightenment scholars would say that we're in. But, you know, this pre-year 1000 and post-year 1000, every Christian European thinks that, you know, in 5 minutes, the Muslims are going to come roaring through and we're going to be dead. Okay? So that's the existential threat that they're living under, really, for, you know, seven centuries. Okay? And so again, last 25 years, that makes sense to us, right? You know, we've kind of been at war, not with Islam per se, but with, you know, certain Islamic groups that, you know, death to America. It's what they're chanting, you know, at Yale right now.
Mike, how would you characterize the
Yeah, it's military and politically, yeah, they become very adept at managing large areas of territory, and they have some brilliant military leaders. They're disciplined forces. They do have sort of that benefit of kind of an earnest, zealous faith. They're doing God's work in their minds, so they have that benefit, and just the relative lack of political structure and stability in the West following the fall of Rome. You know, there's no real army to defend any of this. Okay, it's sort of there for the taking. It's certainly Christian in a lot of ways. It's culturally Christian, but there's no political military. So it's easy pickings, really, for, as we're going to see here in a second, a decent prince with a decent army can hold them off. Okay, so, yes, Nate?
I think a couple of things. Obviously, like you said, military is a combination of military evangelism.
Yeah.
You move in and take over, and now it's an Islamic state. The other piece is, I think that Islam also adapts local pagan, things that may have been there pre-Christian.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's accepting some of those things. So a lot of reasons you see it expanding into Iraq, into modern-day Iran, Persia, was because it incorporated some.
Yeah, they syncretize, like, jinns and genies and stuff like that, which is sort of Arabian paganism. They bring all that stuff in. Which, you can argue that the West does a little of that syncretization too, but, Okay, so now that's going to bring us to the Frankish kings. Okay, so basically the Franks are what the Romans would call a Germanic tribe. Okay, they're Teutons. Okay, they are in the western western part of modern Germany and the eastern part of modern France. Okay, so they're one of the tribes that lives there. Julius Caesar, when he's 9 years old, is up there whipping them, bringing them back as captives. A group of these Franks, they're called Merovingians, okay, had been basically the leaders of the Franks. And this, if you've traveled to, Luxembourg, Holland, Brussels, sort of that little middle section, kind of along the Rhine River, is where their seat of political power is. And so the Merovingians are a declining lot. The dynasty that they have are sort of in decline. And they've got a group of guys that are basically what they call the mayors of the palace. Okay, and it's this family who are just really strong, tough dudes. So Charles Martel is one of the mayors of the Merovingian palace. And Charles Martel, his nickname is the Hammer. Okay, so that gives you a little taste of who he is. Charles Martel is basically going to lead this Frankish army at the Battle of Tours in 732. Okay, so what happens is the Muslims are on their way up on the way to Paris, and Charles is going to go down, and he is going to wipe them out. And he does it so decisively that they basically scurry across the Pyrenees, and we'll stay in Spain, thank you very much. We're not going to come up and mess with that dude, okay, or his sons, or his grandsons, or his great-grandsons, because that's no good. Plus, it's cold up there. So Charles Martel is the guy that really is credited with stopping the sweep of Islam through Spain up into Central Europe. Now, Islam's still going to press, but it takes them really another seven centuries before they take Constantinople. So this really sort of stymies their growth into Europe. Okay, but the existential threat is there. So basically, what Charles Martel, his son Pepin, who didn't get the Hammer nickname but got the Short nickname, so I wish Dr. Storr was here to revel in one of his brothers being lifted up in history. But basically, Charles Martel is a huge supporter of this re-evangelization of Northern Europe that's going on. Okay, so he supports Boniface, okay, who we talked about last week. Remember, he's the guy chopping down the oak tree. Okay, so he's a guy that works with Boniface and is supporting evangelization, you know, back into Northern Europe. And he also reaches out to the Bishop of Rome. Okay, so he is a Western, Northern European, you know, he's not really the boss yet, but he's the military boss. And he's telling the popes, hey, we're here to help you too. Okay, so he sort of sets this trend of a Western political leader. Remember, there are no more Roman emperors. There haven't been in 300 years. And we're going to help you guys. Okay? So he dies. Pepin the Short reigns for a pretty long time. And basically what's going to happen is the Merovingians are going to be kaput. And the House of Charles Martel is going to rise and become the kingly line for the Franks. Okay? So that's the handing off from the Merovingians, which were kind of on their way down, to the what are called the Carolingians, which are the House of Charles. Carol is how you say Charles in Latin. Okay? Pepin the Short also works on his relationship with the Bishop of Rome. So Pope Zachary is the guy that he's working with. And then his son, Charles's nickname is the Great. So we typically hear him as Charlemagne. That's the French version of this. In Germany, he's Karl der Große. Okay, Charlemagne's much more melodic. Germany stinks, frankly, as a melodic language. German stinks. So basically, Charlemagne becomes ruler of the Franks, and he is just cut out of the same cloth. He's a warrior king. So this guy into really his 60s is getting on a horse every spring and leading an army to go fight. Okay, these pagan tribes that are still up in Northern Europe. So he's a warrior king. He loves God. He loves the church. And he's doing everything he can to essentially prosper the church. So back to that monastic model that we talked about, a church, a school, and an infirmary. Okay, he's pushing that out. Okay, and so he is also bringing in scholars. So he's interested in books. He's interested in the preservation of learning. So his number one guy is a guy named Alcuin, who is actually English. He brings him down, but he's really responsible for a tremendous flourishing of learning the arts. You pick the art style, he's got it going on, and he's fostering and paying for all of this while he's going out and kicking pagan booty. Okay, so he's really a remarkable guy. Friend of the church, so he goes to Rome not infrequently, and it's in sort of a visit to Rome where the Bishop of Rome surprises him, none of this is planned, but he basically comes in when he's in a church, and he says, hey, we got a little ceremony for you. You're now the Holy Roman Emperor. Okay, now that's not something Charles was thinking. It's not something he really knew about. But he basically gets anointed as the king of Western Christians. Okay, so this is, in Noel's mind, this huge step forward because it's really the first unified political Christian anything in the West since the fall of the Roman Empire. So he says, Noel argues, and I have to agree with him, that this is what's going to lead to the concept of Christendom. Okay, so Christendom just means Christ's kingdom. Okay, so the idea of the West being this unified place where politics and the church are all working together to point people to Christ, okay, and to create a Christian culture, okay, is the idea. So this is a pretty, you know, not specific to Noel, a pretty well-known idea of this sort of medieval synthesis. And so really where it starts is this basic theological notion that, you know, man was created to be in communion with God. Man fell and is therefore in need of salvation. Christ has come to bring that salvation, and he's instituted the church to be sort of the vehicle for that. Okay? And then when we die, we're going to be glorified. Okay? So basically that creation, fall, redemption mindset, which hopefully everybody in this room is operating under, is the mindset of Christendom. Okay? It's the way we order our understanding of the world around us. Okay? You see a bad thing happen, you don't go, well, why did that happen? You know why. We live in a fallen world. Okay? You do something that you shouldn't do. Okay? You don't go, why did I do that? You know why you did it. You're redeemed, but there's still remaining sin and, you know, what the Bible calls the flesh. So you're in this sort of, you know, not finished state where, you know, you're not fully redeemed because you're not fully sanctified yet. And you won't be until you're glorified. Okay, so it's the worldview we still operate in. Okay, now my wealthy Yale student that's, you know, wearing the keffiyeh and, you know, saying death to America in New Haven, okay, they're not operating under that mindset, are they? Okay, they see something they want to call evil, you know, Israel defending itself against Hamas, okay, and, you know, their categories of good and evil are radically different than ours because ours are coming from this biblical understanding, and then, of course, the Bible informs us. So in Western Christianity, the church basically is the purveyor of this sacramental system, which is how we get right with God. Now, one of the big things in the Protestant Reformation is going to be, well, how many sacraments are there? What are the sacraments? But, you know, we're a church that takes baptism and the Lord's Supper very seriously, right? Okay? Who here grew up in a Protestant church that did the Lord's Supper every week? Anybody? Sigh. Okay, sigh's it. Okay, none of the 60-year-olds did, okay, because, well, you'd had to grow up Anglican or Episcopal to do that, okay? So you can go to Baptist churches today that celebrate the Lord's Supper every week, okay? My kids go to those Baptist churches, okay? So I'm telling you that, you know, for a Protestant church, you know, we take the sacraments pretty seriously, but in the Western Roman Church, the sacraments are really, they kind of devolve into sort of a spiritual banking system, if you will. Okay, they're things that you put, just like your bank account now, you put credit in, money in, okay, and every time you sin, you're taking money out. Okay, and the game, if you will, is to die with more money in the bank than you owe, right? So, unfortunately, we probably all know people that have, you know, $50,000 in credit card debt, right? They got way more debt than they have cash in the bank. Okay, so don't live like that spiritually is sort of the model of medieval Christianity. Yes, ma'am.
Is this the Carolingian, is that how you say it?
Carolingian
Renaissance, or is this a consequence?
This is the consequence of this, okay, is this unification of a relationship between the church and the state. So the synthesis, the medieval synthesis, really has multiple syntheses in it. And so in government, there's a sphere for the church and there's a sphere for the state. Okay, so now, as Presbyterians, we have this idea that there's certain things that we say, okay, this is sort of the government's job, this is the church's job, this is the family's job, and we try to keep those sort of distinct. So, you know, the American Revolution is a fight over what's in the government sphere, what's allowable by the government. So the West is always going to have these kind of discussions. The East is really not, because the East is going to say the church is under the ruler, and so whatever the ruler decides is what the church does. OK, Okay, the West is not going to do that exactly. Yes, Mike?
So when we're talking about the creation, fall, redemption motif, when you were explaining the monastic cycle of history, so I'm picking up the monastics thought about it in terms of maybe governmental cycle, but didn't get it on the personal cycle. It sounds like there's the same cycle motif.
Well, yeah, so a lot of it goes to leadership, right, Mike? You know, you've got a leader that's personally godly. Okay, you're going to tend to have that example and influence trickle down. Charlemagne, for example. Okay, when we get down to Charlemagne's grandsons, you know, Lothar and, you know, Louis the Fat, you know, these guys, some of them couldn't give a rip about Jesus. Okay, so, you know, that's going to trickle down. Okay, so we all sort of get that in leadership today. I mean, that's the big emphasis, you know, the John Maxwell stuff, right, is the character of the leader is really important. So I think part of it's that. I think part of it, too, ends up being money and lands and wealth. I think it breaks down for a lot of reasons. But certainly, by the kind of late medieval period, a lot of it's pretty broken, okay? And a lot of it had to do with the bishops of Rome becoming, you know, captive of the Borgia family and these other Italian families that were devils, you know, literally devils. Just because I'm late here, just wrapping up, the synthesis between government and the church, okay, so there. It's not government on top of the church. It's not the church on top of government exactly, although they're going to fight about this all the time. But basically, there's, in its best version, there's this real coexistence between godly leaders and government and godly leaders in the church. We're all trying to aim in the same direction, okay? In learning, okay, there's not really any conflict between Christian faith and science. Science is sort of working out your Christian faith in the natural world. Okay, so that's true of the medieval period. It's going to be especially true following the Protestant Reformation in Protestant countries. You know, you're thinking God's thoughts after him to study physics, chemistry, biology, anything else. Okay, because he made it all. Okay, so that idea informs the foundation of Western education. Okay, and there are still schools. I get to teach at one of them. That believe this and practice this. Okay, now Yale used to believe this, they don't anymore. Okay, Harvard used to believe this, they don't believe it anymore. You know, all these places used to believe this, okay, would to God that they believed it again. Okay, and then the arts. Okay, so, you know, we sing at church. Okay, there's a flourishing of the arts that comes in the medieval period. There's a flourishing of arts in the Renaissance period. There's a flourishing of arts following the Protestant Reformation. Okay. What's the big deal about art? Okay. Why does music and literature and, you know, pictorial art, why does all that matter? Okay. Well, biblically it matters because we are created in God's image. God is a maker. Okay. He made us to make things. Okay. So that emphasis on the arts in the West. Now, other cultures have arts. I'm not saying that, but, you know, generally speaking, you know, I put the cathedral at Cologne there because, you know, those towers, those bad boys are 1,200 feet tall, okay? And you can stand there, and they've been around for 1,000 years. You can stand there and look up at them, and you can see them doing this in the wind, right? They're moving, okay? So the craftsmanship, they can build, you know, would to God this building's still around in 1,000 years, right, should Jesus tarry, okay? But, you know, we just don't build stuff like that anymore, okay? Just the incredible productivity of the West is just, you know, it's mind-boggling. It's all because of this synthesis that comes about where there's, you know, you're living in a unified world, okay? It's not your Christianity over here and the rest of life over here. Everything's together. And I will say that that, to me, is really the Bible's view of life, is that every area of life Jesus is Lord over. There's not an area of creation that he doesn't say mine. Okay? That's their idea. So, I think of that as a Reformed Protestant idea. That's a medieval Catholic idea, too, at its best. All right. I'm really late. Yes, Sam?
Could you take a second, though, to talk about the false decretals, including the donation of Constantine? False decretals.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, so there are some very creative forgeries that exist throughout the history of man, but there's some good ones in the medieval period where somebody writes up a piece of paper. Constantine says, basically, "Hey, church, you get to tell us what to do." Okay, yeah, he didn't really do that. He was way too canny to do that. But yeah, there's all kinds of, and I'll just say this: I'm painting kind of a rosy picture. The tussle between secular rulers and the church in their country is what's going to break this system apart. So when the Protestant Reformation comes, remember, Henry doesn't believe any differently than the Roman Catholics do. Okay, he just wants to be in charge of all this stuff in England because it's his country, not theirs. It's not the Bishop of Rome's country; it's his country. Okay, so it's an unstable mass in some ways, and it really only works when rulers of both spheres are godly people and are trying to do the right thing before the Lord. So I'm way late. I got to pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for the blessings that we have in our past. Thank you, Lord, for just the tremendous testimony of, 1,000 years of people who really did love you and try to build a world in which you were glorified. Help us to be faithful in those kind of projects too, not just in our families, which is of course where it begins, not just in our own lives, but in our businesses, in our relationships, in our civic organizations and duties, and tennis clubs and vacations. Just help us to be lights for you beyond mere personal piety. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. I did have a hymn, but it wasn't working because I was having internet problems. So we sing "All Glory, Law, and Honor." It's written in Charlemagne's court. It's one of his dudes wrote that. Thank you, Mrs. Rumsley, for that one. That's a good point.